So what are we doing? I feel like I just interviewed you. But I just love talking to folks who are interested in this whole subject.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's always a lot that we can talk about.
Welcome back to another episode of 1980s Now, a weekly examination of the importance of 1980s pop culture and its influence today. My name is Will, and although I'm not joined by my usual co-host Kat and John, I am going to be joined by a very special guest, Liz Wirth. Liz is a journalist and an author, but most relevant, actually all of those things are relevant, and you'll understand in a moment. I was going to say most relevant to our discussion today is that she's also a host of a podcast, Forever 80s podcast, where she's taking a look at trying to determine why folks continue to be fascinated with the 1980s. We don't, you know, consider that on our show. I consider that in real life, I suppose, but on our show, we really try to instead draw the connections between what happened in the 1980s as far as media goes to how it's still living on today, and usually in other forms of media, influencing people and that sort of thing. We have on occasion spoken to some other folks that are, you know, continuing to keep the 80s alive in one way or another. But that's what Liz is all about. Liz is trying to figure out, you know, why we continue to be fascinated by this decade. That's, you know, a long time ago as far as time goes, right? But when thinking about this and thinking about talking to Liz today, it had me considering myself, you know. So folks, were the 80s, I keep wanting to say that they were 30 years ago, right? But that's not true anymore, because if they were 30 years ago, it's more than 30 years now, right? But 30 years ago in the 1980s was the 1950s. And we've talked about this on our show. Our parents at the time and other adults, other folks who were adults during that decade, were pining for the 1950s, you know, which was their time, their generation. And some of their interest was nostalgia. But some of it, like today, was driven by politics. Because every generation seems to think, or tends to think, that things were better back in their, you know, quote unquote day. I'll tell you right now, it's not true, right? Things always continue to get better as history goes on. They get better. What am I talking about? This got me considering, this is what I'm talking about, regardless of the reason, our pop culture in the 1980s, some of it was just straight up set in the 1950s, like Happy Days, Stand By Me. Think about Back to the Future. In Back to the Future, an 80s teen literally travels back to the good old days of the 1950s, you know? I mean, it's just, anyway. But other than that, I don't know that I was fascinated by a generation, the generation of my parents, you know? I liked their music and I heard it because of my parents, but I didn't otherwise try to maintain or live an aesthetic, you know, or style that I associated with that earlier time. Now, that said, there were a little bit of influences, right, that were ubiquitous in the 1980s. Denim jackets were popular again. You know, leather jackets were popular. Penny loafers. These are all things that were first popular in the 1950s. But me and my friends, you know, were into those things. So in that sense, I guess we fell, you know, into that. But other than that, the way I wasn't looking to recreate the music of my parents, you know, I wasn't otherwise, you know, greasing my hair. I didn't have a, a ducktail? Duck's ass? A DA, right? Some of my friends had that, actually, now that I think about it, though. A DA, they called it, you know, which was, again, a greaser's thing from the 50s. But there are young kids today, and you know, and God bless them, they are maintaining the pop culture, the aesthetic, the style, the music of the 1980s. And that's what Liz has been digging into, among other things, and some other really fascinating things. We exchanged emails about some really interesting, you know, questions that she raises for herself and on her show about nostalgia, our fascination with things from prior generations, and in particular for her and us, the 1980s. You know, enough of me talking around her. Let's bring her out. She's the author of several wonderful books spanning fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Her book, Treat Me Like Dirt, An Oral History of Punk in Toronto and Beyond, 1977 through 1981, is the first to document the histories of the bands and the fans that brought the punk scene to life in Toronto during its nascent years. Additionally, our guest is the host of the Forever 80s podcast, like I was telling you a moment ago. That's a show which examines why the 1980s are so enduring. She explores this topic by speaking with guests, including some too young to remember the decade, and, quite honestly, some that weren't born yet. But these folks have been keeping the pop culture of the 1980s alive today. To find out more about our guest and purchase her punk rock history, check out the show notes below. Please welcome to the show, Liz Wirth. Hey, Liz.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going well. I'm so excited to speak with you. We exchanged some emails and you talked about some really fascinating things you're interested in. But certainly you came to my attention because, you know, you're talking to a lot of the folks that I follow on Instagram. So I've listened to a number of the episodes where you've spoken to these younger folks. And I say younger, most people are starting to be younger than me at this point, but younger in the sense that they may not have even been born in the 1980s, or they were and they were young, and they're, you know, looking to recapture in their clothing, their music, or whatever. What led to your interest in speaking to these people?
Well, one of the things that I find interesting is that there are so many people who are committed to the 80s in terms of seeing it almost as a lifestyle at this point. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is this, right? Is it nostalgia? I think it is to a certain extent. Is it a community? Some people will say that there is an 80s community. Some people will also say that maybe, you know, maybe it's a culture, maybe it's a subculture. I don't know. I have a lot of questions about what's attracting to people to the 80s. It's my favorite era, so I'm not against it at all. I think it's exciting. And I think that we need younger people interested in previous cultures in order to keep those things alive, you know, keep those memories going, because otherwise we lose our history if we don't have people re-engaging with it. But there's also, I think, a big difference in terms of this era that we're in that I'm also wondering, like, what is the current culture that people are tapped into? It seems like we've lost some kind of collective spirit along the way. So those are the questions that I'm exploring.
You know what you just made me think of? this isn't a gripe. It's going to sound like a gripe. But our demographic for our podcast is mostly folks my age. They're Gen Xers, you know, so they're a little bit younger and some a little bit older. Does that range? But it's only a small fraction of folks that are of the age of the people you're talking to. So there's things that they love about the 1980s, adopting the look and style and music, et cetera, like that. But, and look, this is just anecdotal. I have nothing else to put this on, because some of them follow me. They don't seem to have an interest in maybe hearing from an old guy who lived in the 1980s and experienced the things that they're, you know, longing to recreate.
That's so interesting. This is making me think of a couple things. First, you know, when I've talked to some of the younger people who are really, again, committed to the 80s, they're dressing 80s, they're creating a lot of content inspired by the 80s. A lot of them have told me that they get comments from Gen Xers, and Gen Xers mm-hmm. will say, you know, thanks for bringing back the memories. Thanks for keeping the 80s alive. Right. So I think they have a similar demographic to you. And that might be part of the nostalgia factor there, right? People
yes.
are, you know, obviously we're going to gravitate back to what's familiar to us. But I know that, again, there are also some younger people out there who I think are looking for that. You know, part of it might be at this moment, the influence of Stranger Things, right? Which is quite a popular show and has really, I think, helped with that 80s revival. But yeah, I think that, you know, what you're experiencing is not uncommon in this little corner of the internet.
Yeah, I guess I don't know that. Well, look, I love talking to my parents. I love hearing stories from my elders, you know, about their old days. But I don't know that I want to listen to a podcast of someone my dad's age talking about the 1950s either, though. So even if I liked the clothing. So I guess I kind of like it too.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think it depends, you know, on what your perspective is, right? For me, I've always been interested in the history of pop culture, the history of subcultures. For me, you know, I've always kind of dug back into the past anyway, just through my own interests. I, you know, when I was in high school, I was really interested in goth culture. I always wanted to go to the goth clubs downtown to hang out with people who were twice my age, if not more, who, especially if they'd been into the goth scene in the 80s, because I was like, these people are going to have the really cool stories. Yeah.
Yeah. I need more of you for a listen. So in our email exchange, and I'm not going to get it exactly right. I don't have it in front of me, but you had mentioned that you're digging into this idea of, or you're looking to, you want to maybe do some additional research with regard to nostalgia, how it operates in cycles, and maybe how up until a point, but it's changed now. And I'm wondering if you've got it all figured out yet. I mean, how is this idea of nostalgia coming in cycles, maybe affect or answer how people today, these young folks today, are interested in the 1980s?
Yeah. I mean, I also asked the question even for myself, because as I mentioned, when we were emailing, when we look at the patterns of pop culture, from the 50s up until the 90s, every decade had something specific that was happening. And a lot of the time, the culture that emerged decade by decade had some kind of response to what had come previously. And it was often trying to rebel against it or do something different or innovate against it.
Right.
And then in the early 2000s, I was a freelance writer, and a lot of what I was writing about was music, pop culture, but also subcultures and the lack of subcultures that we were seeing in the early 2000s, where all of a sudden there were a lot of people sitting around going, like, you know, we had grunge in the 90s, we had Riot Girl in the 90s, where's our next thing?
Right.
And it wasn't coming. And you know, I think now that was, you know, I wrote an article in 2008. I was inspired by, I was walking down the street wearing a Nirvana shirt, and this kid, he was maybe 14, was like, "Wow, I love your shirt, rock on." And I was like, "How do you know what Nirvana is?" Right? It's the same, you know, the same kind of response I think that people often have when you've grown up within a certain generation, and then younger generations start to notice the things that you know about. But I was like, how come he doesn't have his own Nirvana, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And so, yeah, I did, you know, I started to do more exploration into that and looking for sort of trying to figure out where things were headed or what, or if anything was going to happen that would be as culturally significant as youth movements that we've seen in the past and cultural movements that we've seen in the past. And now that I've had a bit more time to think about all of that, I think obviously the answer is that a lot of our creative energy is going into technology. Mm. And that's, you know, that's become really a signature and symbol for this generation, this time that we're in. But the strange thing about nostalgia is that there was a time when it wasn't cool to go through your dad's record collection, right? It's become cool to do that.
I don't know. When would you suggest that would have been?
I think if you talk to you, again, it depends on what people's reference points are and what they're interested in. But my first book and my biggest research project into pop culture was on the punk scene in Southern Ontario in the 70s. And a lot of those people were trying to create something that was in response to the hippie generation.
Sure.
And they wanted, again, they wanted to get as far away from that as possible because they wanted their own thing, right? And they wanted, there was this, you know, this collective mindset to, you know, again, to grow against what had come before, to innovate against it, to experiment beyond it, to push beyond it. And that's kind of stopped, right? Now there's this huge celebration of the past.
Right.
And when I talk to younger people who were born in the early 2000s, a lot of their reason, at least so far in what I've heard from them, is that what they're looking for, yeah, it has something to do with the music, it has something to do with the fashion. They like the aesthetic, they like the sound of it, they love the movies, but what they're really looking for is an experience that they haven't had. Hmm. And that's a time where there was no technology and we weren't all plugged in like this. I don't know what to do with that information yet. I don't, you know, my podcast is quite young still.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting. You know, I'm just kind of listening and observing at this point.
That's so fascinating. Cause you know, we just recorded a show yesterday where, there was this, article that came out by a writer named, Ted Gioia or Goya. I think it's Gioia. I don't know how you say it, but he wrote a piece on the evolution of entertainment and where we're going. And the conclusion was where we're going is bad. And the reason why is because you've got all these, there's sort of a, you know, a shrinking of traditional media, either because music companies aren't investing in new artists, movie companies are making more money selling or writing movies off like Warner Brothers, what it's been doing lately with, you know, canceling films and writing them off. Scripted TV series, there's fewer these days. And he said, well, it's not because people want less entertainment. It's because what's filling those voids is what he calls distraction entertainment, or distraction is replacing entertainment, which is just the constant swiping on TikTok or Reels, et cetera, because that's enough. That gives us a dopamine hit every couple of minutes that we then try to, you know, capture after that video ends and so on and so forth. And his fear, of course, is that entertainment companies know this. They just need to do that. You know, they just need to create little things and just get people hooked on this. And it will be cost effective and, you know, but it's interesting to me that you say that what you're saying, because it almost sounds like maybe some younger people are saying, are either subconsciously or consciously, you know, hip to that and saying, you know, I don't like that feeling of being hooked on something and then hearkening back for a generation, you know, we had technology in the 80s, obviously, but certainly not as what we is today.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting about the entertainment aspect of it. But yes, also I agree. I think that younger people are very aware, right? It's just like the Breakfast Club, right? The whole message of the Breakfast Club. Young people are aware of what they're going through, right? I think that that's something that they all have in common so far in terms of the people that I've interviewed. Is when I ask them, what is it about the 80s that you're so drawn to? They say, I'd love to have a day where I didn't have a phone. Mm-hmm. Just one day to see what that's like.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And they perceive it as a time. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you remind me, you said like, you were talking about how like in the 70s, you know, but the punk rock scene and my recollection in part, you'll know better than I would, but what a little, I've had a couple of folks who've written punk books about, but not obviously it was the evolution of punk in New York or some other areas of the country. One guy wrote a book was throughout the country, but in America, not in Canada, obviously, was part a rejection of 50s music, right? So basically taking rock and let's just speed up the BPMs, you know, and just do it a little, you know. But those folks are rejecting nostalgia of the past. These folks you're talking about are not the pop culture of the past. These young people you talk to are rejecting the pop culture of now.
Yes, yes. And the fashion of now too. And that's another thing that they've talked about in terms of, you know, fast fashion, it's very disposable. People don't value things the same way. You can go online and order anything you want. And if you break it or you lose it, you can just order another one and someone will bring it to your house.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? There isn't the same kind of appreciation for things. There isn't the same kind of work ethic to really save up for something. And once you have it, you really want to hold on to it and appreciate it. I think that in a subtler way, there's also that and that attraction to vintage culture that people have too. Outside, you know, I do a few other things, but outside of writing, I do vintage reselling at a local antique mall here in Hamilton.
Oh, very cool.
And yeah, it's a very small side thing that I do with my husband, but I've learned a lot about vintage culture through doing that and what people are drawn to and why they're drawn to it. And it's always so much more about the physical stuff. Of course, people have collections and again, they enjoy the aesthetic and they want to decorate their home a certain way or look a certain way. But there's something about those items where they're like, if people are excited when they see something and they can say this was made in the 1940s and it's still in perfect condition, they're really excited about that, right? You know, that quality that I think a lot of things don't seem to have in the same way these days, because it does feel almost soulless to some people.
Yeah. You remind me, I had this conversation with, you might see this guy on TikTok or Instagram, Luxury, who's a guy who does like short videos about a sample used in music, and he'll explain, hey, or somehow the evolution of a song, you don't realize that this song comes from this song, right? Anyway, really smart guy, knowledgeable about music. And he has a show now that he does on Sirius or something like that. But we were talking about in the context of sampling, for example, just to give a specific example, in the song Vogue, Madonna Madonna's producers, or, you know, when they created that song she did, they use this horn hit that you've, if you've heard Vogue, you heard it. It's like, bam, bam, right? It's like, if you hear it in the song, you associate it. Now, that's actually a sample of another song that clearly was knocked, was ripped off. They got in trouble for using that horn. I believe that Madonna lost that lawsuit because they just lifted that exact thing. And the conversation that Luxury and I had was, is that, and we believe you should be able to sample things as long as you pay for them and credit them. The problem with sampling is you can't without permission. Unlike covering a song, anybody can cover any song. You don't need permission. You just have to pay the artist that created it. Anyway, Madonna's producers could have just had another guy come in the studio, do a horn thing for me, right? Bam, bam. All right, that sounds exactly like it. But they didn't. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of thing about connecting. Like, it's like that vintage thing you remind me of. Like, I can get a lamp that looks just like it. It was made at IKEA. And it's just, no, I want the one from that era. There's about having it and connecting to it. Like, there's a through line created through my story.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think people like things that have memory attached to them. Not everybody, right? There, I think a lot of people also look at this world, the vintage world, they look at nostalgia. They're like, that's weird. And, you know, and that's fine. But I think people who are really committed to vintage as a lifestyle, yeah, they want that memory attached to it. They want, you know, even if it wasn't their memory, there's something about that that makes it, that gives it that added layer of information, status, whatever it is. There's something more to it rather than having to see where that item might go, right? Maybe it's not going to feel as special in the future. We already know what's attached to something from the past, and you can kind of project your own story onto it, even if you don't know who owned it before.
Right. Mm-hmm. It is weird, right? Like, there's this thing that we can't, it almost seems supernatural in a sense, mm-hmm. that there's, you know, all that information, that energy is embodied in that object, mm-hmm. that intuitively, and look, maybe it's just a bunch of nonsense, but that we want, that we connect with as humans. It's kind of awesome. And
yeah,
I don't know, elusive, because you can't, I mean, what are you describing or talking about other than, like you said, the history maybe?
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but you know, I grew up going to thrift stores because my parents loved going to thrift stores. And so most of my life, that's where I've often gone shopping. And I have clothes that I've found at secondhand places, and I, you know, pull it off the rack. I like how it looks, but when I really look at it, I can tell at some point that this item was worn so regularly because there will be certain places that are really, you know, really worn down. The buttons might be really worn or really loose. You can tell that this has been buttoned up over and over and over again for years. And this is probably someone's favorite outfit at one time. Right. And it's so exciting to wear something like that because, you know, you're giving this object a second life, and it's fulfilling its destiny all over again.
Right.
Yeah. And it feels nice. I like that. It makes me happy to think about that.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting how you think of it that way. Like, it's part of the person there with you, and it was, well, it was loved. And now I have this thing that was loved, and I love it. And oh gosh.
Yeah. And you start to wonder, what did they do in it? Right. Did they wear this to work? Did they, you know, was this their favorite outfit to go out with friends? You know, what kind of stories did this outfit have? What did it see? What did it experience? Now it gets to have all these new experiences with you.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if, you know, you were talking about how nostalgia is different, you know, today than it was, to whatever extent it is. And I do wonder in part if it's because, and I was talking to somebody about this recently, that whether it's different in part because of the technology we have. So for example, in the 1980s, we just started having VCRs and Walkman, you know, and then CDs. And so movies that we enjoyed as kids or music, we were starting just a little bit to be able to have at home in a way that prior generations couldn't. And not enough though. So that when the '90s come along, 2000s, and you know, I grew up in the 1980s, we came up age in the '80s. I started looking for those things, you know, all right, well, I know I could find it. And then eBay becomes a thing. And then you could start hunting these vintage items down. But for kids today, or have grown up, let's say starting in 2000, maybe they don't have to do that because of the internet and technology, all the things they've ever had, they still have in some way. Mm-hmm. And so what am I really longing for? You know, I could just, That TV show I remember seeing when I was six. Oh, I could just get it on YouTube. Like, I have memories of shows that I track down and they seem like fever dreams, some of them, you know? And when I find it, it's like rewarding and it acknowledges something. But if I don't find it, it feels nice to just remember it, you know? But kids can't do that. They just, I don't know, maybe. It's just a theory.
Yeah, I do think that that's a significant cultural shift. And it's a great question. It's a great question. Yeah, you're right. We used to have to really cherish those things because they were so ephemeral.
Right. I guess for me, something you said made me think about this idea that my show is about the 80s. Again, it's for me, and for me, partly, it's definitely nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But really, I truly believe, and I say this, people think I'm kidding. I think it was the closest in the modern day era we've come to a renaissance, and maybe one even more important than the renaissance of, you know, during the medieval times. Because, and I think there's analogies to be drawn with the, you know, development, the more globalization, technology, et cetera, and so forth. And so I think it was the last decade that was like that in a sense, as far as big innovations and things happening all within a span of 10 years. So I poo-poo maybe decades later, but along those same lines, I don't know what is a 90s thing. Big pants. What's a 2000s thing? Like, people, I've seen this meme before. You've probably seen it. It's like if Marty McFly traveled back 30 years today, he would land in, you know, 1994. What would that be? Like, in Back to the Future, it's distinctly different in the 50s and iconic, these images. In the 80s, yes. I don't know what the 90s are. And you go past that. What is an iconic shirt to look for? I grew up in 2010. I'm going to find that. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah. And even if you think of, you know, something like grunge that did define the 90s to a certain extent, although grunge was very short lived too, right? Yep. It seems like it lasted for the whole decade, right. But it didn't. It didn't. It was actually very quick. But a lot of grunge was also, the style in some ways was really similar to what we saw in the 60s. Bell-bottom pants were really popular. Corduroy was really popular. Long straight hair was really popular for men and women.
Right.
So to me, you know, and I was a teenager in the 90s, and that was always how I perceived grunge, because I, having grown up in the 80s, was obsessed with the Wonder Years, which was a show about 60s nostalgia. So I knew all that fashion. And I was like, this just makes me feel like I'm living the Wonder Years, but the 90s version, which was a little bit weirder. even grunge, I think it wasn't, grunge felt very rebellious and I think quite dark and self-destructive in a lot of ways. Mm. But I learned as time went on that it wasn't really innovating against what was coming before in the 80s, because the 80s were such an innovative time for technology, and we can't discredit the importance of keyboards and electronic instruments, synthesizers that were becoming so much more accessible.
Right.
In the late 70s and early 80s. And that's what gave us that defining sound of the 80s that people sometimes like to make fun of, right? That, you know, that really shiny new wave synthesizer sound. But that was a really important technological innovation for music. And grunge was, you know, trying to speak against that and bring music more back to a guitar-based sound, which is fine, right? You know, people are allowed to rebel. This is what was happening in a cyclical level for a while.
Sure.
But then you're also realizing that there's this loss of appreciation for the innovation that we were seeing around sound in the 80s.
Yeah. I thought it was curious that your most recent guest, who does the cosplay as a Ducky from,
Pretty Big. Yeah.
They said, that the 90s was kind of saw the 90s as a rejection of the 80s. Like, everybody wanted to get as far away from the 80s as possible.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. And maybe it's because I grew up in the 80s, but it may be true for me even, because maybe 80s was, you know, childhood for me. You know, I was 10 through, you know, I guess, or whatever it was, 8 through 18 in the 80s, something like that. So I could see, in a sense, maybe wanting to get away from childish things only to come back, you know, by 2000, 2010. Now we're feeling nostalgic, but I don't remember us in the 90s being so, except for maybe like the example you gave with grunge, maybe trying to flee the 1980s.
Oh, it's so interesting because that's also how I remember the 90s is that if you were anything that looked 80s at all, even though, again, the style lasted a little bit longer, right? I think, you know, the 80s lasted, you know, maybe into 91, 92. And then, when grunge was really coming out, if you had anything acid wash, any pants that looked tapered, high waisted, anything like that, it all of a sudden looked so dated. And I remember seeing music videos that were still being played here in Canada that were made in the 80s. And all of a sudden the contrast just seems so distinct. And all of those bands looked so dated with their, you know, their mullets and their big hair and everything. And yeah, I felt like the 80s for a while became very, very, very uncool. I don't know, but that was, you know, that was when I was in high school. And I think in, you know, from a teenage perspective, there's always so much conformity happening and in teenage worlds. So I don't know if it, you know, if maybe different for, you know, in different places, different contexts, I'm not sure, but I definitely have that impression as well.
Of course, the funny thing about any of this, right, is it's contrived. It's a contrivance. A decade is a contrivance.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
So, like the way you suggested, the 80s lasted until the 90s. Yeah, of course, you know, and it began in the 70s. I mean,
yes,
it's kind of funny like that. But I guess I think of things more of a continuity, you know, of the evolution of things, you know, how one thing just continues to affect the other. No, that's, as I know you don't disagree with this, but a stark cutoff. But you're right. Probably if there's any cutoff, it's based on fashion and peer pressure. And
yeah, and I think a lot of that has changed, too, in this era where all of those timelines have flattened now and there is no one distinct style or trend. There's a lot more freedom to dress how you want. It's a lot easier to find vintage clothes because we have eBay and Depop and whatever. Right. There's a whole bunch of other ones now, Mercari. So I think there is a lot more openness around that. But what we're also missing in this time is those collective experiences. We're not moving through waves together anymore.
Yeah, I do miss that. Yeah, I've had that. Yes. Water cooler talk is non-existent now. Yeah,
right.
There's nothing to rally around. And I wonder if, and part of that is, so part of that's a bad thing in the sense that, like you're saying, we don't feel more connected as a society. And, you know, in many ways, we are very, you know, a separate. You look at the United States, you know, politically, it's like more distinct sides than probably ever in history, I think, except maybe back to the Civil War. I don't know. But thinking about fashion, you know, I wonder if part of it is, you know, that where you could, everything's sort of accepted and available is because there's so much, you know, there's so much of everything that's available all the time. Maybe that's the flip side of what I was saying. Nothing is really 2024. So therefore, anything could be 2024.
Yeah.
And that part's probably not bad because we're more accepting of people. So you don't get made fun of wearing tight jeans. Mm-hmm. I could wear my skinny jeans, you know, in my 50s and nobody will make fun of me. All right. My friends will. But yeah, so that might be a good thing. But yeah, I do miss the things that brought us together, you know?
Yes. And I think too that, you know, that might be something else that draws people back to specific eras and draws people back to the 80s, where, you know, everyone was experiencing these really interesting films and bands that have gone on to be quite significant at the same time, right? And now things are so fragmented. And, you know, I think with social media and platforms like TikTok and YouTube, there are people who are having great success there. And there are bands and artists and comedians that have millions of followers on those platforms, but no one outside of those apps are aware of those people. So if you're not in that world, then you're missing out on what the current culture is. And it's really hard to get a read on what the current culture is sometimes, unless you're finding the same things on TikTok that everyone else is, and you're within the same algorithm that everyone else is. And so it's, you know, yeah, I think we're missing out on those collective moments together and that ability to say that we have, you know, we have any sense of what, you know, what the pulse is right now for what is 2024, right? Or what are the 2020s going to look like overall? I think that's an unfortunate thing because it's also hard to predict where does this culture go in the future, right? We're, you know, we're in this golden age of pop culture where we're still able to experience a lot of the bands that we loved in the 80s. OMD's on tour, Psychedelic Furs are on tour, Simple Minds are on tour, right? This is still a great time to go out and enjoy that music. Yes, those bands are older. Yes, it's been a while. They've been on the road for a long time now, but it's great that they're still able to get out there and have a fan base. But will the bands that are popular in 2024 be able to do the same thing 20 or 30 years from now if such a small fragment of the population was only ever to discover them, right? We know those other bands from the 80s because they were on the radio and everyone was listening to the same radio stations. Everyone was seeing the same music videos.
Yeah, those music was
everyone
used in the movies.
Listening to the same soundtracks.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. What does this mean?
What does it mean? I don't know. I feel like it's, like I said, it's a great time to get concert tickets. Enjoy it while we can.
Yeah. I'm not big on concerts. Because I would love, like, if I could pay the premium, sit right down in front, and then, oh, yeah. I'm usually in the nosebleeds, because they charge ridiculous amounts. Now, I don't know about the retro fellas, but you know, people that go, but maybe it's more reasonable.
It depends, I think. You know, if you want to see Depeche Mode, that's a small mortgage on your house.
Yeah, exactly.
That's I think it's I worth it, say. Though. Yeah.
I want to see New Order, Depeche Mode, but I didn't. And the thing about the radio at the time, right, it was this idea that you might listen to a station that's top 40 in the 80s, but they're going to throw a band in there that's in, top 40 was a range. And so you're going to hear somebody that you wouldn't otherwise pick, let's say at a record store, and now learn about a new artist. Yeah, with these algorithms, I'm not learning anything new. I'm just getting served up what I like already. It's kind of lame and boring.
And that's what it's designed to do, right? Yeah. To send you things that you already like so that you'll stay there, you'll keep enjoying the content. And I don't know if that's, you know, it serves the platforms, it serves those companies. Mm-hmm. It serves creators who are already speaking your language, but I don't know if it serves us culturally in a broader way because it doesn't expose us to anything new. And, you know, I would love to be discovering more new, interesting bands, but I don't get sent that stuff on social media. I really have to go digging for it.
Right.
And yeah, like I said, I miss the day where I could turn on the radio and hear something new and interesting. And I think that was a great time also for artists to have that opportunity for, you know, for DJs to be able to say, hey, I heard this cool song. I want to play it. You know, the radio, the days of the radio DJ have also changed a lot. And a lot of those jobs don't even exist anymore. They just use robo DJs now. If local radio stations are even around. So I think that's another gap that we're missing. Right.
Yeah, on Instagram, I see occasionally these, you know, new wave artists who sound like stuff from the 80s, you know, or want to or try to. And I love a lot of these groups, but it's hard to find them unless I happen to come across or be recommended them to me.
But,
you know, it's interesting, just the considerations that you're having with regard to this exploration you want to do about nostalgia is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, it's also for myself, right? Because, like I said, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s and then... That was also when I got really into the 80s because there was this period where, everyone, at least around me was trying to get away from the 80s. And then I got really into, you know, first wave punk, 80s goth. And a friend of mine gave me a mixtape one day and had a bunch of Smith songs on it. And I'd never heard the Smiths. And I was like, what is this? This is great. You know? And so I started just following these other threads. You know, I was getting into Sisters of Mercy. Yeah. The Smiths was a great gateway for me. I really loved the song, Pet Sematary by the Ramones that they did about the movie, you know, and I followed all these rabbit holes into more 80s music. And I was like, why is everybody so against the 80s and the 90s? This stuff is amazing. And I just kind of stayed there after that. And then once we got into the early 2000s, I noticed that a lot of other people were starting to stay there too. Yep. And so I think, you know, I don't think this is a new phenomenon that people are so dedicated to the 80s or interested in that era. I think this is something that's been going on for a long time. And again, I think that that is some kind of, you know, I don't know if it's a symptom, a symbol, but it says something about, I think, the culture, in that we've really embraced nostalgia in a way that I don't know was happening at such a deep level previously. I could be wrong, but yeah,
you know, in a previous incarnation of my podcast, I was set out to prove that nostalgia did not account for our love of the 1980s. Mm. Obviously, it plays a role, but I guess to your point about how it's always been sort of, you know, there's been this interest in it, in spite of what you might have thought as far as people being against it. Obviously, decades that before, look, we still listen to music from the 50s, 60s, 70s, et cetera, and so forth. And I think maybe part of that is like my parents raised me on their music. You know, it wasn't until I was getting closer to being a teen that they would consider what I might want to listen to, or they listened to top 40. Prior to that, it was whatever they listened to. And that was great for me. A great musical education. It created, you have a more diverse base, you know. And for me, then I added my 80s stuff and 90s mm-hmm. stuff. And then for my kids, exposing them, it's almost too much. Like, I don't even know where to begin. So they hear some stuff, mm-hmm. But I don't think that's happening as much nowadays. So I think, or maybe there's nothing to share. I don't know. Again, I don't know what a 2000 song is. I'd have to look it up. Kind of blends together after those distinct decades to me.
Yeah, it's, I think it's, you know, we're in a strange time. You know, people always make art, and human creativity is, I think, when, you know, it has a lot of capacity. There's stuff out there. I feel for artists who are trying to get their work noticed, yeah, because yeah. they're really on their own to do it. And I think that, again, there can be a lot of benefits to that. You know, I know a lot of musicians have said, if, you know, if they had social media or the internet in 70s, 80s, 90s, that they would have found that to be of great benefit to them, because they would have been able to get their work out there. But it's also so competitive, and everything is based off of how many likes you're able to get. And yeah. if people see your content, and you could have the best content and people might not see it, which is just a really right. sad, unfortunate reality that we're in, right? We're in this constant popularity contest. And again, so much of our energy is just going into what we're doing on our screens just to get that little bit of attention around our work.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would probably be what Joya, that I told you about earlier, would talk about, chasing that dopamine, you know?
Right.
But yeah. And right. And now you're doing a podcast, which you said earlier, so you're still pretty young, but you get that. Look, I've been doing it for a few years now. It's frustrating because you feel like, this is interesting. I'm doing a good job. It's hard for people to find, because everybody has a podcast.
Yes.
And you yeah. know, I really wish that we still had some, this sounds terrible because I'm all for the democratization of lots of things, but I do feel like it would be great if we had some gatekeepers. Maybe the gates are wider than they were when record companies were treating people terribly and movie studios would give people terrible contracts, that kind of thing. But still some kind of tiered system of allowing, like you're talking about, I'm really saying all this to really just talk about my own podcast, but I'm talking about in the context of these other artists you mentioned, that the best people can be found because there's some kind of gated system that lets, you know, I mean, I wish there was more of a yeah. balance. It's like we open the floodgates and like people can now, you know, content is taking a picture of your food or just waking up and recording a video saying, or, you know, what you did yesterday, and I'll post that. Mm-hmm. And whether nobody mm-hmm. watches it or not, it's still competition for the, not me, the other people.
Yeah. I mean, this is what we've lost when, you know, this is what we've lost in print media and radio yeah. again, you know, and unfortunately I have a media background. That was what I went to school for. And, you know, unfortunately that industry just hasn't kept up with the changes that we've seen in technology. And a lot of magazines, newspapers, radio stations, even broadcast television, there's been a lot of struggle to figure out, how do you fit that work into our internet culture and now into our social media culture. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about, you know, that those roles were fulfilled by editors right. and critics and journalists and people who spent, you know, their full-time job figuring out what are those things to be talking about next, and what are the things that we could share and we could give a platform to. And those were the gatekeepers. And again, I know people don't always like critics. And there was always a question of who are you to decide what music people should listen to? And who are you to decide who gets the cover of a magazine? But again, that's also how we had all of those collective moments together.
Yeah.
So, everything's a trade-off, right? Yeah. We get a benefit from something, but we also trade one problem for another. And that's, that's a balance that I think humans are always having to walk and figure out. I don't know if we always make the best decisions with it, but, there's certainly a, I don't think it's too late for journalism, but, it's not looking good either.
Right. I hadn't even thought about that. Journalism too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Among everything you said, I feel like I could get really down about the future of pop culture. But the one thing that I think, that I've learned listening to your show and also our conversation today is that there is some hope. And I think for me, the thing that, I'm going to hang on to is this idea that maybe these younger folks are interested in the 1980s as a rejection of the technology of today and the trajectory that we're currently on. And that makes me feel like maybe, and as these kids get older, and a lot of them are adults. They're going to be the ones more responsible for where media is going and is. So maybe there is a way to rein it back from the, this dopamine culture.
Yeah, I hope so. It's always, again, it's hard to know. I think that social media plays upon a lot of things that really, really get us in places that we might not always want to admit we want, but it really speaks to a lot of people's need for attention. People have a strong desire for fame. Right. And I think that those things are big, big attractors with the way our culture is right now. If you people try to go famous for anything, right? People spend, hours and hours trying to make viral videos just for the hope of getting something that's going to maybe get a million views and that people will forget about in a week, so it's so sad. I know it's so sad, but I think that these are the things that on an individual basis, we have to overcome if the culture is going to shift. Are people again collectively interested in overcoming these things? I don't know. I think that when we look at things that have become really influential, right? Like punk, for example, new romantics, all of these things now that are storied within the history of pop culture. Those groups are often quite small, but they had some kind of trickle down effect. So, I think that that's always where the hope is that a smaller group of people might have a bigger impact or might be remembered for something. But it's always hard to know where things are going to go these days.
And now you have me speaking of the 1980s, which is what we do on our show. I'm hoping for another pop culture, something that was, pop culture in the zeitgeist in the 1980s, an apocalypse. Okay. Stay with me. That just wipes out the technology, brings us back, not to the Stone Age necessarily, but maybe not the 1980s necessarily, but 90s would be okay,
Dial-up. That would be a happy medium, I think. Yeah. Let's get back to dial-up or something.
An absolutely fascinating topic, one that I consider these things. These kind of stuff don't always make it onto our show, 1980s Now, but it's great to have, other folks like Liz exploring these different angles of our interest in the 1980s in particular, our nostalgia more broadly, right? It is fascinating. You know that because you listen to this show. I hope you do. Are you still there? Is it just me now? Anyway, hey, check out Liz's show, Forever 80s Podcast. You can find it everywhere. As I mentioned, we also have links to her website and a link to bookshop.org where you can get her book, Treat Me Like Dirt. But if you visit her site, she's got other books on there too. She's just a wonderful author and a podcast host. And I hope we can find more excuses to talk with her in the future. Oh, and I may very well be on her show too. I will let you know about that when it's happening. Okay. Hey, on behalf of Kat and John and myself, we will talk to you next time on 1980s Now.